Radio on Radio.
You're listening to Radio Aryan at RadioAryan.com.
Hello and welcome to Truthful Out Radio. Today's date is the 25th of March 2016 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks. We're very sorry we haven't been here for the last 2 weeks, but we're finally back now. I was away for the first week and Dennis was ill for the second week, but a big thank you to Matthew Heimbach, who stepped in to do a live podcast with us, the Traditionalist Youth Hour. So if anyone's looking for what was produced last Friday, they will find it there. Okay, well, we've got an exciting programme for you today. We've also got Messerschmitt back with us, looking at the German war heroes. But first of all, I'll introduce Dennis. How are you doing today, Dennis?
Fine, thank you. I'm back from the land of flu, should we say.
Yeah, you sounded pretty ill from what you were telling me. Flu, it can be quite serious. I've had a bit of a cold myself since I've come back, but I don't think I was as bad as you. You sounded like, you weren't really aware of exactly what was going on.
No, concentration levels were non-existent.
Yeah, well, at least you're back now, and it sounds like you'll be doing some really interesting research that we're going to go into in the second part of the programme. But first off, we're going to look at these German war heroes once again, and today it's Joachim Peiper. So I'll introduce Messerschmitt. How are you doing today, Messerschmitt?
I'm doing okay on this Good Friday, thanks.
Ah, I thought it was good of you to mention it. We were just discussing that earlier, actually, the different names that there are for Good Friday. I think it's called Good Friday because it's Holy Friday. But in Germany, don't they have a different term for it?
Yeah, it's called Karfreitag. And I actually looked this up. The word root kar means something like sorrow, sadness.
So it's almost so it's, like
it has a bit of the opposite meaning in German, but I guess it depends on which way you look at it, because you can look at the sorrowful aspect of it or at the hope that comes from it, I guess.
Yeah, it's also a weekend that everybody's got off, so I think most white countries have the day off on Good Friday, and they have a weekend to think about what happened then and when Christ died on the cross and rose again, and that was the central point, the most important point in all of history. And now that's changed to it being the Holocaust. And the people that actually put Christ to death are the ones that we are supposed to feel sorrow for nowadays, and we're supposed to be the guilty ones. And I believe this story that you've got today also includes some particularly nasty Jews trying to pin the blame for things on innocent Germans once again. Will I be right in surmising that, Schmidt?
Yes, that sounds about right, yes, as we will see. So, should I start?
Yes,
we're going
yes.
to talk about Joachim Peiper. Joachim was his official birth name, but his comrades all called him Jochen, which is simply a short form of Joachim. He was born in Berlin, Germany, on the 30th of January in 1915. His father, Waldemar Peiper, had served as a Hauptmann, that is, a captain in the Imperial German Army. Oh, and maybe I should spell out the name so people can find it if they want to look it up. It's P-E-I-P-E-R for his last name. He had a talent for languages and is said to have mastered French and English almost accent-free. In addition to that, he was also curious about various cultures, especially the French culture, including French literature, painting, philosophy, and even gastronomy. He turned 18 years old on the day that Adolf Hitler was appointed Chancellor of Germany. As soon as he could, he volunteered to join the Hitler Youth. And then he planned to join a cavalry division of the German self-defense forces as his next move. So he seemed to have had an interest in horsemanship. And, I forgot to mention, at the age of 11, he joined the Scout movement. And it was during this time that he developed an interest in a military career. And so he wanted to join this cavalry division of the German self-defense forces. But a family friend, General Walter von Reichenau, advised him to enlist in the 7th SS Reiterstandarte instead. That's an SS cavalry unit. And so he did in October of 1933. And his evaluation by his superiors at the SS at the time reads as follows. Very good in anything related to combat and at the auditorium. Very good talents and achievements. Very diligent and good assessment skills. Tough against himself and others. A born soldier. In spite of his youth, complete maturity. Sense of responsibility. Fit for operational service and of good character. Qualified for leadership. And as we will see, and the years I will recount will show just how accurate that first assessment was. In 1934, he was promoted to SS Mann and later in the same year to SS Sturmmann. Around that time, he had already come to the attention of Heinrich Himmler. And next in 1935, Piper attended the SS Junkerschule in Bad Tölz, the same officer school where Michael Wittmann was trained years later. In April 1936, he was promoted to SS Untersturmführer and reported for duty with the Leibstandarte SS Adolf Hitler. Then in July of 1938, he was appointed adjutant to Heinrich Himmler in July of, July 1938. In this position, he came in contact with many high-ranking SS officers, and he accompanied Himmler on a state visit to Italy. During the Poland campaign, he was still mostly serving in a non-combat role in Himmler's staff, but in May 1940, during the France campaign, when Hitler was observing Waffen-SS troops at the front, he requested to join combat operations and was allowed to do so as a Zugführer, that's a platoon leader, in the 11th company of the Leibstandarte. After seizing a British artillery battery, Piper was awarded the Iron Cross and was promoted to Hauptsturmführer, which is equivalent to captain. Now, your listeners probably know this, but for people new to the subject, it might be worth remembering that it was France that declared war on Germany, not the other way around. Most people have been told in the mass media and in school, usually by lying by omission, that Hitler was on a mad plan of world conquest and had attacked one country after the other without provocation, and that these countries were simply defending themselves from aggression. And this has nothing to do with reality yet. It seems that most people are still under that impression. But returning to Jochen Piper, he returned to his duties as Himmler's adjutant in June 1940, when the France campaign was winding down. He traveled with him to Spain to meet Franco, to Norway, Poland, the Balkans, and Greece. After the war with the Soviet Union had begun, however, he requested to be transferred to the frontline service again, which was granted to him, and he rejoined his comrades of the Leibstandarte at the Eastern Front. They were involved in heavy fighting near the Black Sea when the commander of the 11th Company was heavily wounded and Piper took command of the 11th. Intense battles of the Eastern Front, he kept distinguishing himself as a true leader, inspiring his men to follow him into the most audacious attacks. He deployed the panzers under his command almost as if they were heavy cavalry, dashing into the enemy lines and opening gaps that could then be exploited by the units following up on his charge. And that was how he joined the SS, if you remember, as an SS cavalryman. But instead of horses, he and his comrades were riding heavy panzers. His tactics, I believe, show how true the initial assessment by his superiors were. He was indeed tough against himself and others. He would lead extremely daring night actions by attacking the rear of the enemy lines and capturing four Soviet division headquarters in the process. In May 1942, the Leibstandarte was transferred to France for rest and refit, and Peiper was given command of its 3rd Battalion. He also recruited many young officers who were eager to fight and shared his tactical concepts. In January of the following year, he was promoted to SS Obersturmbannführer, and the Leibstandarte was redeployed to the Eastern Front near Kharkov in the Ukraine. Kharkov had been recaptured by the Soviets that year, and the Leibstandarte, alongside other German units, was tasked with driving the Soviets out again. In the days before the actual assault on Kharkov, Peiper, commanding his 3rd Battalion, was tasked with linking up with General Postel's battle group, which was isolated and had many wounded soldiers with them. And it was fighting its way through enemy territory. The intention was to break through the enemy lines and protect the convoy of ambulance vehicles on their way to pick up these wounded soldiers. 30 kilometers behind enemy lines, they finally found the battle group and during the night positioned their armored vehicles around the battle group for its protection in a type of hedgehog formation. At dawn, the convoy of ambulances carrying the wounded under Peiper's protection started on their way back to the German-held territory and safety. But in the meantime, a Soviet snowshoe battalion had destroyed the only available bridge and occupied the neighboring village. Peiper cleared the village with his men, and the ambulances were able to cross the river on the ice that was still thick enough to carry them. Peiper's panzers and APCs, however, could not possibly do that. They were much too heavy. And so in a wide circle through difficult terrain, they found a way back to the German lines. For these and similar actions around the time, he was awarded the Knight's Cross of the Iron Cross on the 9th of March. In the early morning of the 11th of March, the Leibstandarte launched a two-pronged attack into the northern part of Kharkov, meeting extremely heavy resistance, including counterattacks led by Soviet T-34 tanks with aerial support from the Stukas and Stuk assault guns. The Leibstandarte battled their path into the city, and in a bloody house-to-house fighting battles, were able to clear tactically important parts of the city. On the next day, the Leibstandarte progressed into the city center, breaking through the fortified Soviet defenses. Near the center, they took heavy casualties from Soviet snipers. During the night, Peiper's 3rd Battalion linked up with the 2nd Battalion, and together they smashed their way southward, crossing the Kharkiv River and creating a bridgehead where they dug in and went on the defensive, fighting off any of the several Soviet counterattacks that were thrown their way. On the 13th, the Leibstandarte continued to cleave a path southwards from Peiper's bridgehead, and together with the other German units attacking the city from different sides, they managed to encircle the bulk of the Soviet defenders in the center. The following mop-up operations effectively put two-thirds of the city under German control. And the next day saw the Soviet resistance crumble away with each passing hour. And to give again some statistical data on what the Germans were up against, the Soviets had 346,000 men to defend the city. They were all well dug in and had tank and artillery support. The Germans had 70,000 men, or about 20% of the Soviets' numerical strength, and they succeeded in taking back the city. This was, of course, not possible without horrible losses. Horrible losses on both sides, with the Soviets suffering about 8 times the losses compared to the Germans. Now, returning to a more anecdotal impression of Peiper's life at the front, I could quickly tell of an action on the 6th of December of the same year. Piper and his 3rd Battalion found their way to the Ukrainian village of Kochivka, barred by a thick belt of dug-in and well-concealed anti-tank guns and Soviet infantry. Undeterred, he charged east with his Tigers, his armored group smashing several artillery batteries. His column moved so rapidly towards the village that the Soviet 121st Rifle Division was taken by surprise, and Piper destroyed their headquarters and scattered the Soviet division with his men and tanks. Michael Whitman, who was with Piper that day actually, destroyed 3 more T-34 tanks which were in their way, and Piper commanded a halt to rest and take on supplies. Within 20 minutes, his Panthers and half-tracks were on the move again, firing at any opposition in their way. The headquarters of the 322nd and 148th Soviet Rifle Divisions were run down, and the Soviets thrown into a panic. In their charge, they had destroyed 22 artillery pieces, 76 anti-tank guns, and 40 vehicles, among other things. And moving on, during the Battle of Kursk, Piper and his unit again distinguished themselves in the fierce fighting. On the 20th of November, the commander of the 1st SS Panzer Regiment, Georg Schönberger, was killed in action, and Piper was given its command. He remained its commander until the end of the war, actually. Now came the time of these daring night raids against Soviet forces behind enemy lines that I mentioned already, where he and his men captured 4 Soviet division headquarters. For these actions, he was awarded the oak leaves to the Knight's Cross by Adolf Hitler in person on January the 27th of 1944. In March 1944, the Leibstandarte was withdrawn from the Eastern Front and sent to Belgium, mainly for training and refitting. But training and drills were made difficult by the lack of fuel, which was by that time an overall problem of the German armed forces. The landing of the Western Allies in Normandy forced the deployment of the Leibstandarte. But even getting there was difficult, as the railway traffic was often interrupted due to Allied air raids, and the Luftwaffe was spread so thin it could not possibly defend the airspace effectively. And I've actually seen footage of these German troop transports sitting, tank grenadiers sitting on the tanks, and they're all looking upwards because at any time they expect to be they expect an air raid or be bombed by strategic bombers. Due to the air raids and the constant attrition during defensive battles, the Leibstandarte lost 25% of the nearly 20,000 men it had when moving to the front. The British and American forces had nearly 2,500 tanks and tank destroyers, having near total air superiority, while the German forces had 190 panzers and assault guns. Then in December, what is known as the Battle of the Bulge in the English-speaking world took place. It was a last desperate serious counterattack attempt by the German command at the Western Front. For his actions there, Piper was awarded the sword to the Knight's Cross. And actually, a quite well-known Hollywood movie was made about that battle, also called Battle of the Bulge, I think. And from what I read, there is some consensus that the role of Colonel Hessler in the movie, played by Robert Shaw, is actually supposed to be Joachim Piper. After the Battle of the Bulge, Piper saw action at the Eastern Front again, where he took part in the last offensive in the East. It was a hopeless attempt. The Soviets were just so overwhelming in numbers. And as I said, they had little or no fuel left even. But Piper again led his men with this panache or reckless courage for which he was known for. His unit inflicted very heavy casualties on the enemy, but at the same time, he also lost many old friends there. This was in Hungary. When it was clear that the offensive had failed and the remnants of the Leibstandarte were forced to retreat into Austria, they heard of the death of Adolf Hitler and were ordered to retreat to the West and surrender to the American forces. And then, after the war, Piper was accused of war crimes. At the trial of the so-called Malmedy massacre, he was sentenced to death, like many of his comrades, despite not even having been near the place of the alleged massacre. During the interrogations leading up to the trial, the SS men were tortured to extract confessions. And maybe you can now play sound clip number 2, Sven?
Controversy still rages about Pearl's methods. Many of the accused would later complain about the tactics used to make them talk. There were extended periods of solitary confinement, bread and water diets, even violence in the interrogation room. One even claimed William Pearl himself had attacked prisoners. Others spoke of burning matches under fingernails, and a dentist regularly called to fix broken teeth.
Yeah, this is from a British mainstream documentary, so we don't have to fear that they are somehow sympathetic towards Piper or Germans of the time. And from other sources concerning tortures, it was probably much, much worse than what is only hinted at in this little sound clip. And as to who carried out these tortures, maybe you can recognize the particular accent of the chief torturer there. This is from the actual trial. This is footage from the trial and the sound clip that follows. We will hear the torturer.
William R. Pearl, first lieutenant, with war crimes branch, USFET, at present on temporary duty, the 3rd Army.
When were you assigned to war crimes branch?
In July 1945.
What is your assignment then with war crimes branch during the past 6 months?
I have been chief interrogator on the Malmedy case.
Doesn't sound like an average American to me, but maybe, yeah, people will figure out what nationality he belonged to or what people. So, yeah, it was a mock trial, and the death sentence led to quite a bit of unrest among the German people, including even the church, leading the commander of the U.S. Army in Germany to commute some of the death sentences to life imprisonment. In addition, the German's defense attorney, U.S. Military attorney, Colonel Willis M. Everett, appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, claiming that the defendants had been found guilty by means of, quote, illegal and fraudulently procured confessions, end quote, and were subjects of mock trial. The commission arrived in Europe on the 30th of July 1948 and issued its report on the 14th of September. In this report, it notably recommended that the 12 remaining death sentences be commuted to life imprisonment. The commission confirmed the accuracy of Everett's accusations regarding mock trials and neither disputed nor denied his charges of torture of the defendants. The commission expressed the opinion that the pre-trial investigation had not been properly conducted, and that the members felt that no death sentence should be executed where such a doubt existed. Ultimately, the sentences of the Malmedy defendants were commuted to life imprisonment and then to time served. Piper's sentence was commuted to 35 years in 1954, but he was released in December 1956. The last of the Malmedy condemned to be freed. He had served 11 and a half years in prison. After he was released, Piper worked for Porsche the car manufacturer in Germany. But he was forced out of this position by communists within the ranks of the Porsche's workers' union. Piper later moved to France, where he bought land and built himself a cozy little home. He lived a quiet and discreet life with his wife there. But then local communists discovered who he was and started a campaign and they started sending death threats, basically. And Piper sent his wife away and awaited things to come. On the night between the 13th and the 14th of July 1976, the assailants shot up his two dogs in their kennel and burned down his home with Molotov cocktails. Piper's charred remains were found in the morning. It seems that one of the last acts in his life was the attempt to save some of his wife's personal belongings by throwing them out of a window. They were found the next day underneath the window, not burned. Nobody was ever charged with this crime, and it seems obvious from what I read that no serious effort was ever made to bring his murderers to justice. But I would like to end this with reading something that Piper wrote in 1952 when he was in the Landsberg prison. Please keep in mind that when he talks about Europe, he does not, of course, refer to the European Union of today. It did not exist back then. But I believe what he wrote has a sort of uncanny relation to what we are experiencing today in Europe. So I will read something. This is not the full letter that he wrote. It's the last part of it. The letter is called Worte aus Landsberg, Words from Landsberg, 1952. Quoting, "Where would the West today be without those walls made up of German bodies that cannot be erased from history? From the Caucasus to the Finnmarks, in a wide circle, the front of Occidental battle posts stands. Envoys of our culture are silently standing guard. And even if their grave mounds have been leveled and many countries are still ashamed of their most noble sons, only this avant-garde of the European idea can be thanked that the heirs of Genghis Khan have not yet, in their tanks, reached the shores of the Atlantic. For their sake, let us bury our grievances, comrades. History will judge more justly than mindless contemporaries full of hate. The danger is so menacing and the distress so great that nobody should fail to follow the call. Do not forget that from within the ranks of the Waffen-SS, the first Europeans fell in battle, and those that were slain post-war were mostly from our ranks, and only because of their belief in the unity of the West did they become fair game. Remember these blood witnesses. Do not go only half the way. The spirit of Europe is the only political ideal that today it is worth fighting for. We were never closer to seeing it realized. Grab the lie by its throat, hit the slander into its face, help the neighbors and the war widow. If everybody finds back to himself and the simple values, renounces egotism, turns poverty into ethics, and feels a renewed sense of responsibility towards the community, then we will, even this time, be able to sort this dirty mess out, and the dams will stand erected when the storm flood comes. During the war, our proud divisions were renowned as crisis-proof. To the prison guards of all countries, we have shown our stalwartness. May our children one day be able to say of us that even in calamity, we were not smaller than our destiny, that even in diaspora, we were sowing seeds for reconciliation and European thinking. My greetings go out to all those that have remained free, even in the dungeon. Joachim Piper.
That's very, very moving there. And I just think I make a point there where he's talking about the European and the European idea. He's talking about the white race, basically. And that's what he meant by Europeans then. We would say the same today as if we were talking about the white race. So he's talking about white people uniting and not fighting among themselves. And of course, back then they weren't facing the threat that we're facing today from the third world and with the immigration. The Waffen-SS was truly a European idea, and it wasn't a European idea of throwing away your national sovereignty to a group of Jews. It was Europeans working together for a common goal, but under their own sovereignty. They weren't trying to say that they should lose their nationality at all. They were proud of their nationality, and there were different units for each nationality in the Waffen-SS. And I think you could tell that was a Jew, the interrogator, and that was the actual voice of the guy that was doing all the nail pulling and the teeth pulling that we heard there. And I think he was quite clearly a Jew that did that. So it's interesting to actually hear him admitting that he was an interrogator. And of course, the BBC are not going to be sympathetic at all to the Germans' cause. So when they say they were tortured and they had their nails pulled out, you know that they had much worse things done to them than that. But it is still surprising that they admitted it anyway. Have you got any comments on that you'd like to make, Dennis?
Yeah, it's a touching piece, that letter. And it does ring true about what is going on today. For sure, we know that a lot of Jews left Germany when Hitler came to power, or just before he came to power, knowing what to expect, left and went to America, came back again towards the end of the war because they could speak fluent German. And we used in the torturing of German prisoners. Interrogation. So it doesn't surprise me that the odds on him being a Jew are quite high anyway.
Yeah, they're very high. We're getting a little bit of distortion there, I think, Dennis. So I'm just going to call you back, I think, before we continue. Yeah. All right?
Hello?
Yeah, that's better. Can you hear me okay?
Sure.
Yeah, sorry about that. The connection went a bit dodgy, but it seems fine now. Well, we're going to change the subject matter a little bit now because you've been researching for the next part in Communism by the Back Door, I hear, and it's some pretty interesting subject matter as well. Do you want to explain the first part of it? I believe you've been looking into the Rothschilds is the first part of it. Is that right?
Yeah, they're not the easiest of people to investigate. And a lot has been said and done about the Rothschilds. So I wanted to try and come from a different angle, if you like, because few people know the actual power of the Rothschilds over the last few centuries, what drives them. And I've tried to portray this in the park with the music as well, because as much as Jews plead, you know, that they're always the downtrodden party, it goes on to prove that this is far from the truth. So... Yeah, so we looked into it, and obviously they were involved in a lot of wars over the centuries, a lot of revolutions, got rid of a lot of governments, and the thing is, after two world wars, they still remain unbeaten. So this is quite a powerful dynasty, and since World War II, I think NATO, I think it was Gaddafi who said just before Libya went down, he did a talk to the United Nations, and he was complaining about the 65 wars of NATO in the 65 years since World War II. So just goes to show that there's no peace after World War II. These were wars all around the world. So what drives them? Well, there was a biography about Mayer Rothschild, the founder of the dynasty. And he was quoted as saying that his driving motivation was the Talmud, which, of course, is everything that the Christian or the white race really really want to know about. So going a bit deeper, one or two people have done some really excellent research, we find that obviously they needed help to pull off where the point where they are today. And this includes two tiers of Jewish families in America alone, in the first tier, and then the 30 most powerful multi-billionaire Jews in America, who were all agents of the Rothschilds, all working 24/7 to secure this one world government. Then there's another tier under them of what we could call lesser Jews, probably only multimillionaires. And it's quite intriguing to know that this is, I mean, and even some Christian families have gone against, have gone onto the side of the Rothschilds. And we find that a lot of politicians, of course, who we would think would be, holders up of the community are all Rothschild puppets. For instance, the power of the Rothschilds education system in Oxford is quite evident with the Rhodes Foundation, which we spoke about before, which takes people in from all over the world. But surprisingly enough, I did the background checks of British politicians, and lo and behold, you find that Edward Heath was a member of the Oxford education system. Margaret Thatcher was a member of the Oxford Rothschild education system, as was Tony Blair. So you see the conveyor belt of Rothschild disciples, should we say, coming off the conveyor belt. And of course, you got people from outside of politics as well. I do a little piece on Rupert Murdoch, who is on his official profile, he would be named Christian, but I've done a little unofficial profile after researching on Mr. Murdoch, who was, again, although born in Australia, is Oxford educated, and is has a nickname of Red Rupert, would you believe? And one or two other interesting things I mention. I mean, this is all part of this communist world government that they're trying to put into place, and Murdoch plays a big part in both the elections of Britain and in America because of his major outlets. I mean, one of his major outlets is he owns half the world's Christian publishings, would you believe? And as he claims to be a Christian, we find that he also produces or publishes books such as, Anton LaVey's Satanic Rites and other demonic books which a Christian wouldn't be associated with. So I list them as well. And like I say, the Rothschilds are quite an interesting army of people around them. And then we take a look at the City of London, which has always been a fascination. And we find that, even the Queen there has to ask permission to enter this 1 mile piece of land, which is not even part of England, there's no authority from Parliament or they even have their own police force there. They're just a complete entity, a complete country on their own in the middle of London with their own powers. And the Queen has to actually bow and ask permission of the Lord Mayor to actually enter this particular 1 square mile. And what's interesting enough, I found some information about on the mayor. And he's been chosen by the Rothschilds, a good source that I found. He's been chosen by the Rothschilds since 1820. I mean, they have one every year. They elect a new one every year, and the Rothschilds are always behind this particular event. The city itself is run by 12 to 14 dark, shadowy people from the world of finance. So we could more or less say we're talking about Jewish bankers. And these are people which the Parliament have to turn to for any major decisions because, of course, these people hold the finances. So when we're talking about this shadow government, this is the area that we're now talking about, this hidden behind the curtain, these people who are not democratically elected, but certainly pull all the strings. And therefore, if they pull the strings in London, they're therefore pulling the strings in Washington, because obviously the Rothschilds took control of the Fed the other part of the century. So, yeah, it's all coming. It all falls like a like a jigsaw, to be honest.
So when you want to look at who's at the top of the banking families, it's always the Rothschilds. And they weren't around originally when the Bank of England was formed. And that's first off when the powers started being siphoned away from the monarchy to what became known as the city. And the city of London then became known as the Crown. And it basically, the bankers took over the city and until they had all the powers of the city and all the powers of the Crown, that means, basically. So when people take an oath to the Crown, what they're actually taking an oath to is the City of London Corporation. And the City of London Corporation is run by the bankers with these Rothschilds at the top, although they're not so out front anymore. They hide as the directors of the companies that are at the top of the City of London. And when you get the Crown versus the defendant, which for American listeners, the Crown is the law, basically, against the defendant. What that really means, it doesn't mean the country against the defendant or the Queen against the defendant. The Crown Prosecution Service is the bank's prosecution service. And this is why the police get used as bailiffs now to foreclose on people's mortgages, to kick them out of their houses, because the police are the private security force of the Crown, and the Crown is the banks. So the police are the private security force of the banks. They're not there to uphold the common law. They're there to uphold whatever diktats the banks give out, whatever orders the banks give out from the city to the government. They may make those laws. They make the statutes up, and then the people have to obey them, and the police enforce them. But where it all stems from is these banks, where they've usurped the power of the monarchy, the power of the sovereignty. They've usurped it, and most people don't know that, because they think the Crown just means the monarchy, or it means the Queen, and it doesn't. It means these banks, and it means the people that control the banks, which is the Rothschilds. And you're quite right saying it's like a separate country. It's the same as the Vatican and District of Columbia. All three of those are separate sovereign countries.
Yeah. So, well, there's another one. Yeah, the United Nations is another one.
I don't believe that. Does it? United Nations doesn't actually have any territory, though, does it? I suspect it exists as a corporation.
Where it's built in New York. Is it New York? I think it's New York, isn't it? Where it's built there, that sovereign land.
So that's sovereign territory. Sovereign. It's, you know, this is the way that they twist things. That's the, all the power there that's been usurped has been taken by the Crown. And yet we get all upset that the EU has taken away our sovereignty. But it's not just the EU. And the reason why it was given to the EU is because the Crown wanted it that way, because they control the EU as well. They control the EU banks.
That's right.
I remember there's a book, I'm just trying to remember the name of it. It's about the City of London, and it gives you some of these laws of England in it. And the City of London, the Bank of England, which started off the City of London, they're not allowed to be investigated at all. And the people in the bank are above the law. They cannot be charged with any crimes. How can you charge the Crown with a crime? Because all the law comes from the Crown.
You know, they've got it tied up, haven't they?
Well, yeah, the banks are completely above the law. This is why you won't see the Bank of England audited, because it's above the law. This is why you won't ever see Mervyn King or any of these other bankers in prison, because they are actually above the law, and it's written into the laws of England that they are above the law. It stems from the king, all laws coming from the king. So the king is above the law, which is why when they beheaded Charles I, he said, well, by what law are you doing this? This is regicide. This is murder. You cannot execute a king because you don't have the right to do that. All law comes from the king. So what they did, they transferred that power, all that power that the king had, they transferred it to this corporation, this idea, which was called the Crown, and then they transferred all the rights to that to the city, to the bankers. And that's what became the City of London, the square mile, which is, as you say, it's pulling the strings for all these wars. This is why they went after Gaddafi, because he was going to set up a separate banking system with the gold dinar.
And Germany.
Yep. Yeah, Germany. Germany set up a different banking system. So straight away, the bankers at the top that run the City of London and through their other connections run all the media, start up this campaign against Germany to convince the rest of the world that Germany was trying to conquer the rest of the world, which is rather strange when it comes from the people that are already the bankers to the world.
That's right.
I'm just trying to think of that famous Rothschild's phrase. I care not who makes the laws if I print the money, isn't it?
Yeah, something like, give me the finances of a country and I care not who leads, something on them lines. And you're quite right, because if you hold the purse strings, then nobody can do anything unless they come to you.
And this is why they run the Fed as well. This is why they want all the rest of the world to do all their exchanges in dollars. It doesn't matter that much if it's dollars or euros, because it's all going to the same people, these international bankers. Once you have an international bank, where is that money going to go to? I mean, it's going to go to internationalists. It's going to go to the Jews who aren't a member of any nation, who flip between nations. When you look at the way the Rothschilds set that up, they sent out various different members of their families to these different capitals in Europe with a certain amount of money in order to basically take over the banking system there so that they would be at the top. They would be the ones running things. Now, I find it very interesting that you found a source saying that his biggest influence was the Talmud. Or saying that that's what... it got them to where they are today, because the Talmud just teaches them to cheat the goyim, cheat the Gentiles. They can steal from them, lie to them, do whatever they like to them. They don't actually have any moral responsibilities to us Gentiles.
Well, this is why the Gentiles or the goy who were snuggling up to them. You know, I mean, I've got footage of Arnold Schwarzenegger dancing, you know, with some Jews trying to get this nod to become president eventually, which never happened. You've got people like John McCain who came over to the court of Rothschild over in London and begged to try and become the president of the United States. Clinton, footage of Clinton there, a photograph of Clinton's there with the Rothschilds. They all know where the power is, and they're quite happy to sell the souls. But the Talmud, as you quite rightly say, it even says that, even the best of Gentiles should be killed. So they think they're going to get some handout if this Jewish world order does eventually come off. But I'm afraid they're in for a bit of a shock.
Well, a conspiracy crowd, they'll look at it and they'll say, oh, the crown, well, that's the queen that's involved in that. And she does get a kickback from it. I mean, she does get a large percentage of the money that the city makes, but it's not actually the queen that's running things. And you can see that from the fact that she has to ask permission to actually go into the city. So she's not the one that's...
Well, they're even married into the bloodline as well of the royal family. As far as I can remember, when I was researching a while back, I think even Lady Di was part Rothschild.
Well, the Jews constantly sought to subvert and undermine our true aristocracy by marrying them and corrupting the bloodlines, corrupt and adulterating these bloodlines, so that most of the aristocracy in Britain now is polluted with Jewish blood. This is why the aristocracy have sold us out. This is why, if you look at the politicians or the ones, the people with money in this country, they all act more like the Jews than if they were Christians. The whole banking system is Jewish. A Christian banking system would not have interest in it at all. It wouldn't have Jews in it. Christians are commanded to show charity to their Christian brothers. And that means that if they need money, you don't say, well, you're going to have to pay me double back. You know, you lend them what they need, and the National Socialist way is to give them the means so that they can make the money for themselves.
Well, we covered it in the last episode of mine, usually, and it showed that how corrupt and how powerful that it can be to actually to drive money. Most of the money into a small amount of people and get the vast majority into never-ending debt. Just compound interest is such a powerful force that can never pay back all your debts. So, and these are the people that introduce all this into the banking system, and they've now taken part of England as their own and done what they've done to the European Union, with 28 countries now, you know, giving up the sovereignty. It's all been a covert. You know, I don't think most people knew about it really. They just took things for granted. But it's been a covert action to turn Europe and Britain into a communist state. I also go into the, I mean, it is widely regarded that they are of the Masonic religion of Luciferian, and on their, found some footage on their actual Rothschild estate with the Temple of Apollo. And so, you know, I think it's quite a fact that they're not a God-fearing family, should we say. And they go along with the teachings of the Masonic system of the supreme being, I believe, is Lucifer. So cover much of that in this episode, but there's so much to find and so much hidden that it has been quite a process to dig all this out. So put it all together in a way where people can understand it is the next step, probably about a week or so now.
I think that's one of the things that people don't get, or they don't put two and two together. And you just point out there, the Rothschilds have got a temple to Apollo. All of these people at the top there, these top Jews and the Shavuotskoy, they all have these Greek and Roman pagan symbols that they use. And so I say the pagan side of things is not for us. That's for them. That's the enemy that uses that. They're the ones that use these old pagan symbols and the old sun worship. And the black sun is the opposite of that. It's not the material sun. It's not materialism. It's the spiritual light that animates us and that makes us separate to these other races that the materialist worshippers seek to adulterate and pollute with their race mixing. Once that's done, that's it. That's finished. There's no turning back from that. You can repent from all other sins, but you can't fix something that was created broken, as it were, which is mm-hmm. what that does. And also, I think we should make a point here in saying that, you know, the conspiracy crowd will say that the Rothschilds, that's it. It's all to do with the Rothschilds. They're the ones at the top. They're the ones we need to go after. But the Rothschilds would not have been able to get to the position they're in today without the help of all the rest of their tribe. That's how they do it. It's a biological thing. They're just the figureheads for it. You know, they're just the brains that have made it to the top. But they, in order to do that, they've relied on their tribe helping them all the way through in order for them to get that inordinate power. And that's why the Rothschilds have then paid the Jews back by building that great big courthouse in Israel and various other great building projects that they've begun in Israel. And you've got the Rothschilds Road, the Rothschilds Housing Estate, all this money that they funnel back into Israel that they siphon off from us Gentiles through their usury system. The whole of the banking system is anti-Christian because it's based on interest. And most Christians have sold out to this, and they think that interest is necessary and that it's a good thing if you can make some money from the interest and the usury and then give it back to the poor. But if you didn't have usury in the system anyway, you wouldn't have people living in the poverty line. If we just looked after our own, then our people wouldn't be sleeping in doorways. They wouldn't be homeless because we'd be looking out for them, because we'd have that that feeling of national solidarity that we need.
No, well, that is exactly what Hitler did, and is exactly what Gaddafi did. Because when you look at Libya, free education, you know, free healthcare, all this before this American democracy or Western democracy was forced onto, I mean, let's face it, it's a hellhole now anyway. But, you know, the Libyan people will be in for a real shock, even once, if this is all cleared, all the ISIS, et cetera, is cleared out. They're still going to be trapped in this system of debt, which they're certainly not used to, or they weren't used to under Gaddafi.
It's the democracy system goes hand in hand with it. Wherever they try to install democracy, they also try to install the banks as well, don't they? They don't have democracy in North Korea. That's what they're talking about trying to bring to North Korea. But at the same time, they'll be wanting to bring the banks in as well, because there isn't a bank there. They say, oh, we want to be bringing democracy to Syria. It's not democracy that they want to bring to Syria, because the Syrians have already voted, over 80% of them, for Bashar Assad as their president. But what it is that the Syrians had a separate bank that wasn't a part of the international bank. When that war started over there, they had billions of dollars in foreign currency exchange saved. They didn't need to borrow money for their budget for the year. They had money that they'd actually made. The whole of the banking system is based on debt rather than being based on what a country has managed to save. Right at the top of it, you've got these parasitical Jews like the Rothschilds that are creaming it all off from the rest of us without putting anything into it. That's the thing with interest. There's no industrial capital involved whatsoever. It's all just compound interest, just paying back more and more and more and more and more every year. I think it's taken us, we only just finished paying back one part of the debt from when we went to war against Napoleon a couple of years back. And the money for all those wars is borrowed again from the Rothschilds. Years back, they would say they would fund both sides of the war. You would get to a stage where you would get to a stalemate, and years before in the past, that was it. You ran out of resources. You would have to stop fighting. But now you've got the Rothschilds with all their gold. They would step in and say, well, we'll lend you the money and you can keep fighting. And whoever wins can pay us back. That was the whole point of having human rights law and international law meant that these bankers could then claim their money back from the vanquished foe, because there was then an international law. And if it was just national law and the foe was vanquished, the country would have no money. Of course, it wouldn't be able to pay it back. But now that you've got an international law and you've got a bank of international settlements, they can stand to win both ways. They can place the bet on both countries, and it doesn't matter which country wins or loses. They are still the ones that win and make the money from it. And that was the point of this international law.
I do refute this that they've always backed both sides in all wars, because one of these days I'm going to get to the task of proving that wasn't right about Hitler, about Germany. And it certainly wasn't right about Libya, and it certainly wasn't right about Syria. There's no way they backed them in that side. So it's a myth that the Rothschilds always back both sides in a war. I'm not saying they haven't done it, but certainly cases of these countries like where they're trying to get their own system of currency up, they've no need to back them. They're just sending NATO troops.
Yeah, it's different now. So obviously, it was before World War II was when they were needing to back both sides. You don't need to now, because they're right at the top. They're running their new world order. But that's sort of brings us up to the end of this week's podcast, Dennis. So you just want to quickly let people know where they can find your work while I find the outro.
Yeah, people are still being able to watch it. Adolf Hitler, the Great Story Never Told.tv, the full 6-hour video, and come to me on YouTube for the next episode of Communism by the Back Door, and that's Dennis Wise on YouTube.
Okay, thank you very much for listening. We'll be back next week at the same time with Truth Without Radio on Radio Aryan.
Tuned in to